Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Pacific Underground. It's a show by Asians and Pacific Islanders taking the mic and taking over KBOO. And at 9 o'clock, right in just a minute or two, we'll be listening to One Land, Many Voices, today hearing from the author of The Unchosen, The Lives of Israelis' New Others. It's an in-depth look at African asylum seekers and migrant workers in Israel. We're going to hear a couple of announcements before we move on to One Land, Many Voices. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today.
Open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Black Women for Peace 2017 Peace Festival on Saturday, June 24th at 5 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory in Portland. The fourth annual Peace Festival, We Stand for Peace, will feature music, spoken word, dance, and more from culturally diverse artists. Again, that's the Black Women for Peace 2017 Peace Festival on Saturday, June 24th at 5 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Today, One Land, Many Voices features a talk and book reading given by Maya Garneri Jaradot at Tabor Space in Portland on Tuesday, June 20th, 2017, about her new book, The Unchosen. It's The Lives of Israel's New Others. This book provides an in-depth look at the lives of African asylum seekers and migrant workers in Israel.
I'd like to start with this. Your book focuses on Israel's treatment of migrant workers and asylum seekers. And I'm wondering if you could please describe for us how it is that Israel came to rely on migrant workers.
Okay. Great, thank you. That's a really important question, and it's a great starting point, because with that question we can make the connection to Palestine. Israel, after the occupation began in 1967, there was something of an opening, if you will, of the territories to Israel, and workers started to come in from Gaza and the West Bank. And Israeli employers quickly became very dependent on this labor pool. There was also, from the government's perspective, there was some, they liked the labor pool of Palestinian day laborers because they would go home at night, right? So there wasn't the concern that these people would stay and take root and, you know, change the demographics. These men, for the most part, were going home to their families. But when the there are kind of two processes that kind of happen that you know, you need to think about when we start talking about why Israel shifted away from Palestinian day laborers and towards migrant workers, which in the beginning, and I talk about this in the book, they referred to as foreign workers. So you want to talk about two processes. You want to talk about the kind of attempt to kind of better control the movement of the Palestinian population, right? To assert more control over the territories. And you also want to talk about separation, okay? So Israel started to bring migrant workers at that time from Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia during the First Intifada. Now you're going to find some things online that say the Second Intifada, and that's actually incorrect. They want to pin the presence of migrant workers in Israel to the Second Intifada as a result of suicide bombers XYZ, but that's not the case. It started earlier. It started during the First Intifada. Israel, in 1991, revoked the general exit permit that Palestinians held that allowed them to kind of, you know, and I use the term freely very, very loosely, you know, because there was not absolute freedom, obviously, right? But more or less, if you held a general exit permit, you could exit the territories and go into Israel as a Palestinian. Now, in 1991, this general exit permit was revoked, and they revoked it first for the people in Gaza, and then it was just a general kind of revocation, and it was over. And that became the beginning of the permit system we see today, which is that people have to apply for exit permits. You know, in the case, and I think it's such an extraordinary example that I'm going to offer this up to you. If you're a Palestinian married to an Israeli, you have to apply every single year. And I offer this as an example because my husband is Palestinian and I do hold an Israeli passport. So if we had decided to remain there, if we had wanted to live inside the Green Line, he was going to have to apply every single year. And every single year, those families, you know, live in that period where it's, Baba, is Dad going to get the permit? Is he going to be able to stay with us? But that's kind of me digressing. Okay. So Palestinians have to apply for this permit that allows them to enter, you know, Israel. Now, there's also some nuance to that because, as we all know, probably the checkpoints and the separation barrier are well beyond the Green Line. So you're talking about asking people to apply to enter land that, you know, if we're setting aside 48 and just talking about 67 and the Green Line, you're asking people to apply to enter land that technically they should be able to enter without a permit. Setting that aside, so Israel revoked the general exit permit in 1991. By that time, it was already bringing migrant workers from Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia. And there was quite a demand, in particular for construction workers, because of the aliyah, or immigration, from the former Soviet Union. Okay, we had this influx of Russian immigrants. And Russian, you know, you use this as a term to refer to all those people who came from the former Soviet Union. So there was a demand for housing. There was a bit of a housing crisis in Israel. There was a housing shortage. At that time, Palestinians represented something like 50% of the laborers in the Israeli construction sector. So there was a demand, particularly for construction workers. And couple that with the Intifada and Israel's attempts to kind of, you know, impose collective punishment upon the Palestinian population. So then you have the Israeli employers, of course, inside freaking out. Hey, we need workers, right? So what's the solution? Okay, we'll bring migrant workers from Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia. So the Israeli government started to import these migrant workers. As I talk about in the book, almost immediately there was a concern. Oh, wait a second, we're bringing these non-Jews. They're not like Palestinian day laborers who go home at night. These are people who are staying and they could influence our demographics. There was concern right away. You know, in the early 90s, you had Israeli governmental officials articulating that Palestinian day laborers go home at night. Migrant workers might stay and have families. You had officials saying things like, we need to deport them before they become pregnant, way back in the 90s. So that's kind of where this started. So, you know, I think that a lot of times people don't understand that the migrant workers in many ways have become, you know, not just a physical stand-in for Palestinians as separation has deepened and as the Israeli population has less interaction with the Palestinians. You know, now there's this new group of others there that have become a kind of, you know, physical and psychological stand-in upon which a lot of those, the kind of racism and other issues are channeled towards these other non-Jews, you know. Obviously, a lot of that is still channeled towards the Palestinians as well, but now with them kind of locked out in the territories, there's a different dynamic, you know. Yeah.
And what about African asylum seekers? Where did they come from, and how did what was Israel's response to their appearance?
Yeah, thank you. So African asylum seekers have been coming to Israel in very small numbers since the 80s, from different places in Africa, but very small numbers. And so the Israeli government didn't have much of a policy. You know, the numbers were so small, it kind of wasn't a big deal. I think they were kind of dealing with it on a case-to-case basis. They definitely were not processing requests for asylum, but they weren't, you know, they were granting a group protection to asylum seekers from different countries. Now, you see in 2005, there was an incident in Egypt, in Cairo, where a lot of the Sudanese asylum seekers, you know, when they leave Sudan, they end up in Egypt. There are tremendous problems in Egypt, tremendous challenges that the Sudanese face there in Egypt. So the Sudanese in 2005 made a big protest camp in Cairo outside of the UNHCR, and basically demanding to be moved to another country. The Egyptian government cracked down on this protest camp, and dozens were killed. It's not clear how many were killed. Some reports say that children were killed as well. And so the Sudanese kind of gave up on Egypt and at that time started to flee. And that's about the time that we saw the first wave go into Israel. At that time, I don't think the Israeli government anticipated how large that migration would become. They didn't really know what to do with these Darfuri refugees that kind of showed up there. And the border with Egypt, you have to understand, was quite open at that time. So, you know, the refugees, asylum seekers, because Israel doesn't acknowledge them as refugees. So let's use the language asylum seekers. They would go and literally, leap over barbed wire. You know, it was like bundles of barbed wire on the ground in the sand. They would run. The Egyptian army would be firing at them from one side, you know. They'd leap over the barbed wire and tear up their legs and arrive in Israel. And the army would pick them up the army would pick them up and usually take them to a base and, you know, keep them there overnight, give them water or food or cigarettes and let them sleep there. And then the next day they'd be taken to jail and held for an indefinite period. Now, there was a group of 500 Darfuris in the early years who got temporary status, but the ruling, they didn't get refugee status, they got temporary residency. And so it was a way of Israel partially giving them their rights, but not actually recognizing them as refugees. And this was at a time that Israel didn't really have a policy. It was a policy of non-policy, we call it. Now, in 2006, you saw more come. By 2007, it was really a large number. And by 2007, we're not just talking about the Sudanese, we're also talking about the Eritreans, okay? And Eritrea has just kind of recently made it into the news as, you know, people have started to pay attention to what's happening in the Mediterranean with the Syrian refugees. And they say, the media says, oh, there's other people on these boats besides the Syrians. Oh, they're Africans. Now, the Eritreans have been going out since, you know, 2000. And they've been crossing those boats, getting on the boats and crossing the Mediterranean since 2000, a long time. So they started going to Israel in, you know, 2006, 2007, they also started to go to Israel. And the Eritrean are fleeing a very brutal dictatorship. And Sudanese, as I'm sure you all know, you know, war, genocide, so on and so forth. So Israel at that time started in, I would say, about 2007. You see this gradual shift, and it took some time to kind of formulate the policy, that they started to move from a policy of non-policy to a clear policy of deterrence, which is what we see today. The policy of deterrence is kind of, you know, that they won't process asylum seekers' requests for refugee status. They just don't process them. There are thousands of applications that have been turned in that the Israeli government just doesn't process. Because, like, you know, if you give status to one, well, that opens the door to others, right? So we have something like 4 Eritreans have gotten status over all these years. Now, the approval rate in other countries, you know, depending on the country, runs anywhere from 60 to 80% for Eritreans. So a tremendous majority are granted status elsewhere in the world. So that's where things are kind of at now. This policy of deterrence, that they don't process the request for asylum or refugee status, I'm sorry, that the asylum seekers do not get legal status in Israel, has a variety of repercussions. They're also not allowed to work legally. So the Israeli Supreme Court ruled, however, that this is not quite legit. So the government kind of turns a blind eye to them working illegally and is now taxing them to death. So on the one hand, they're not supposed to work legally, but they're also supposed to pay something like, 20 or 30% of their income now in taxes to the Israeli government, which is impossible when you're, you know, working on the black market and making below the minimum wage, and then you have to pay 20, 30%. So there's these policies of deterrence. They also built a barrier with Egypt. So now you have almost none going in. And they're just kind of dealing with the population that's inside Israel. At its peak, it was 60,000 African asylum seekers. It's down to 40,000 because the policy of deterrence has been very effective. They also opened a detention center called Holot in the south in the desert. And the asylum seekers are held there without charge and without trial for periods of 12 months at a time. So that's the status now.
Maya, you spent about 10 years in Israel as a journalist, writing for publications like The Guardian and The Nation and 972 magazine. And you've written, of course, about the migrant workers and the asylum seekers for those publications. And you've also covered a lot of other issues, too. One of the things that struck me about your book is that you write that Israel's treatment of migrant workers and African asylum seekers resembles in some ways Israel's treatment of Palestinians. And this calls into question Israel's position that its treatment of Palestinians is based on, quote, security concerns. Mm-hmm. Would you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. That's a great question. I think that the best place to start with that is with the case of the children of migrant workers and the children of asylum seekers. Clearly, Israel has no claims against, you know, a 2-3-year-old who's born inside its borders and hasn't asked to be born inside its borders. You see that the children are not recognized by the Israeli government. They're not recognized by the Israeli government, and they're not recognized by the Ministry of Welfare. The children are recognized by the Ministry of Education. So at the age of 3, they get to go enter the school system, the municipal schools, that in Israel starts at the age of 3, different than the U.S. Before the age of 3, there's no framework for them because they're not recognized. So these children go, because their parents can't afford to pay for daycare, these children go to these black market kindergartens, and that's my first chapter in the book. It's about the black market kindergartens. If the children were born to an Israeli citizen and their parents can't afford daycare, the Ministry of Welfare, you know, kicks in and helps to cover that cost so the parents can work. But, you know, these children who Israel has no security claims against, I want to emphasize that, you know, don't have that right. So they go to these horrible black market daycares. South Tel Aviv is full of them. They're unlicensed, they're unregulated. Sometimes you have maybe one caregiver with 40 children, and I'm not exaggerating. I've seen things like this with my own eyes. She keeps them, you know, we're talking about children below the age of 3. Now, these are years that are critical to a human being's development. And in these critical years, you know, the ganenet, the caregiver, she will put them in pens and leave them there for the day. Because that's all, I mean, I don't want to, I'll get choked up. It was a horrible thing to see. And she'll leave them there for the day because, you know, it keeps them safe, like safe. And that's the only way she can keep up with them. So she might change their diapers and feed them. Sometimes they can't even keep up with that. I had a woman, a Nigerian woman, who ran a kindergarten, one of these kindergartens, that had improved by the time I went and saw it with the help of an NGO. She had hired some other workers. It was much improved. But she admitted to me that in the years that she was alone and with 40, 50 kids, that she didn't always get to feed all the children. There are children and babies who have died in these black market kindergartens. Now tell me, what is Israel's security claim against these children? So this, at that point, you understand that it's about demographics, you know, that these children are not recognized and they're not given their most basic human rights because they constitute a demographic threat to Israel. So, you know, we use the word conflict to talk about Israel-Palestine, but sometimes I think that using that word is problematic because it sets up a kind of bilateralism, right? And then equivocates the sides. And what we're actually talking about is a very powerful country that's got, you know, backing from the U.S., financial and political backing, and that's attempting to assert hegemony on a population, right? It's Jewish hegemony. And, you know, Israel with the Palestinians can say, oh, but look, we've had suicide bombers. But, oh, look, we've had this, we've had that, But they can't say that with the children of migrant workers. That argument disappears. They have nothing. They have no leg to stand on. You know, at that point, you see that it's just about demographics and hegemony. And to me, you know, as a human first, as a Jew second, you know, the black market kindergartens were just like, that was the breaking point for me. That, like, you can't buy any of the arguments. There's no argument. You can't offer me an argument. You just can't. You can't defend it.
Could you summarize what the current legal situation is for migrant workers and asylum seekers?
So as far as the children are concerned, because Israel lacks immigration law for non-Jews, you know, it has opened 2 one-time windows for the children of migrant workers. Now, 2 one-time windows, you get the kind of oxymoron there. They keep opening these one-time windows because they don't want to make any sort of proper policy or laws, you know, that would end up in the naturalization of a large number of non-Jews. So they open a one-time window here and naturalize a few hundred. They open another one-time window there and naturalize another few hundred. And that's it for the children of migrant workers. The migrant workers themselves are brought to Israel on 63-month visas. They get the visa on the condition that they don't enter romantic relationships. If they're caught in a romantic relationship, they can lose their legal status and be deported. So that shows, I mean, immediately, that's Israel trying to tackle that issue that they identified in the 1990s, which is that this group of non-Jews will lay down roots here. So okay, they say no romantic relationships. There's a prohibition on that. There's another policy that migrant workers are not supposed to have babies in the country. And it used to be that, the policy gave the woman 3 months from the time of the birth of her child that she could pick between keeping her visa or sticking her baby on a plane and sending her baby to the country of origin. So you have these ridiculous scenarios where if a woman wants to keep her legal status, now also understand that the migrant workers are coming to Israel in debt. Okay, they pay these manpower agencies, you know, astronomical amounts of money for the manpower agency to set up the work and to get everything set up for them in Israel. So it's called debt bondage. And they've taken out loans. In some cases, maybe they've put up, you know, they might own a little bit of property that they've put up as collateral, so on and so forth. So for a migrant worker to lose their legal status in Israel is no small thing because they're in debt. A lot of migrant workers spend the first 2 years of their 63-month visa just paying back their debt. So, you know, if you get pregnant, say in your second year and you haven't paid back your loan yet, then what? If you get pregnant in your third year and you're just now starting to save money for yourself, then what? Okay? Now, of course, there's human rights implications too for telling people that they can come to your country, but they can't procreate. So this policy was actually struck down by the Israeli High Court as a violation of Israel's own labor law. The Israeli the government, though, ignored the Supreme Court ruling, the High Court's ruling, ignored it for 5 years. Okay, now this is something typical we see in Israel, that when the High Court gives a kind of more liberal ruling, quote unquote, that leans towards human rights, the Israeli government will just ignore it. And when it doesn't ignore it, it will try to outright circumvent it. So then we can also see what happens to, you know, the democratic space when you have a country that's trying to uphold hegemony of a particular group, right? What happens to the democratic space? Well, you see that the government ignores its own Supreme Court or High Court, right? So that then the checks and balances start to kind of wobble a bit, right? So in 2011, the Israeli government the Knesset finally came up with something, a new law, to address I mixed it up. I'm talking about the binding arrangement. I'm talking about the binding arrangement rather than the handling of pregnant workers. Sorry, strike that. But that's another issue. So they changed the policy about the pregnancy, the migrant workers in pregnancy. But it's the same effect that women still cannot give birth in the country. And if you give birth in the country, you lose your legal status, okay? So there's that. There's the binding arrangement so the binding arrangement was stuck down in 2006, and the binding arrangement bound an employee to a particular employer, giving that employer an incredible amount of power over the employee. So if an employer fired you, you would lose your legal status. And this was struck down by the Israeli High Court, as was the pregnant migrant worker policy. They were both struck down by the High Court. In both cases, the government came up with harsher restrictions. You know, so the High Court strikes it down, and the government says, okay, you don't like that? Well, you know, here's what you get. And I write that in the book. It's a proverbial middle finger to the High Court. So what came in 2011 in the Knesset is something that the human rights organizations call the slavery law, you know, that substituted for the binding arrangement. So it became even harsher. So that's the legal status. Now, as far as asylum seekers, they're still not getting refugee status, even though the community is even smaller, even though maybe now it makes more sense than ever to just absorb them. We're talking about 40,000 people. That's not a lot of people, you know, 40,000. What is that? That's nothing. So they still don't have legal status. You're still going to Cholot. I mean, that's it. It's very simple. Their children don't get legal status. Their children who are born and raised in Israel don't get legal status also.
You mentioned Filipino and Thai workers in particular frequently in the book. And I wonder if you could talk a little more about their situation.
Okay. first, I want to say something about why I chose to focus on Thai and Filipino workers, because there are many different countries represented there. The Thai workers, I thought, were important because they work in agriculture. What does agriculture mean, like, you know, in Israel? It has a special meaning in Israel. That first, you know, Zionist settlements were kibbutzim. They were collective agricultural, they were collective farms, right? And this is really the backbone of the Zionist movement, the kibbutzim, and this idea of working the land, you know, avodah ivrit, Hebrew labor. It's to work the land and redeem ourselves as a people by being on our land and working the land. You know, it's deep. It's a big, big part of Zionism. So that you had Palestinian day laborers doing a lot of the agricultural work. Again, almost 50% before Israel started bringing the tie to replace them is very significant. And now, you know, it's not really the Israelis doing most of the agricultural work. It's no longer the Palestinians, it's Thai workers. And you can go to some, you know, farms and see more Thai there than Israelis. So it really calls into question this kind of, you know, idea, one of these kind of founding myths, right, of Israel, and how that founding myth is playing out today. So the Thai workers, too, tend to be some of the most exploited. They come to Israel with almost, you know, no English, all of them, obviously no Hebrew. And they're really, you know, picked up from the airport and then put on these very remote locations. And they're subject to really serious exploitation. Of course, some of them get paid like they're supposed to, and some of them get their rights as according to the law. That happens too, and I want to acknowledge that, but many of them don't. Many of them see their bosses cutting all kinds of corners, on housing, on salaries. I interviewed workers who, you know, their boss would charge them a fee, would wire the money back to Thailand, but for a fee, so it was skimming off of those checks. And then they were forced to go buy produce from the little store on the kibbutz that was owned by the boss's daughter, like things like this. So, I mean, the Thai are really in a very bad situation. So I chose to kind of include them, even though I feel that their chapter sticks out a little bit, but that's an issue, that's a craft thing, never mind. The Filipino workers I chose to include because they are really the largest community in Israel, the Filipino migrant workers. And most of them go, they enter a racialized system of labor. Migrant worker who goes to Israel enters a racialized system of labor. So in the past, Chinese went into construction, and Thai went into agriculture. The Filipinos are brought to work as caregivers, and they get visas that, you know, are specific to their sector, and they're not supposed to work outside of that sector. Now the Chinese used to work in construction, and they paid something like $30,000 to go work in Israel, which is a mind-boggling amount of money. Now the Chinese are being used in the ethnic food industry in Israel. So those of you who visit, and if you go to Tel Aviv and hit one of the many, many sushi, Tel Aviv, they love sushi. And if you go into one of these sushi restaurants and you see an Asian fellow making your sushi, you know, most of the time, most of the chances are he's a Chinese worker. And often being exploited as well. So, but the Filipino is the largest community in Israel. They're very organized. They're really willing to fight for their rights. So that also makes it a really interesting group to look at, that, you know, when Israel has tried to deport the children of the Filipino community, they haven't taken it lying down. They've gone out along with Jewish Israeli activists and fought these deportation schemes. Yeah,
that's another thing that really struck me about the book and that I liked a lot. It's not just about the horror stories, but it's also about the people's resistance and the people's fighting back. And I am now looking forward to your reading because your writing is so superb.
Oh, thanks.
And so I think maybe now would be a good time for you to read the selection that you wanted to
do. Okay, great. I'm like, oh, that's right. I'm doing a reading, too. I was so caught up in, like, giving the kind of background. Yeah, should we put it on the stand? So I'm going to read a bit about the situation of Filipino workers in Israel and their children. The book is pretty much split in half. It's pretty much half migrant workers and half asylum seekers, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tough call, but let's read about the Filipinos. So I'm starting on chapter 5, which is clean and tidy, quote unquote, foreigners in Israel after Operation Cast Lead. And you know, the title of the chapter is quite revealing, because many people feel that Cast Lead kind of constituted a real shift in Israel, a real shift in what Israel was willing to do, and Israel's kind of lack of caring about the response of the international community. And it was after Cast Lead that you saw Israel end its informal policy against deporting families. So up until 2009, Israel followed an informal policy that it would not deport these children who were born and raised in its country. After Cast Lead, in the summer of 2009, Israel announced that it would start deporting the children of migrant workers. And I think that the timing, you know, there's something worth noting there. And it also, and
What year was that? I didn't hear it.
2009, yeah. Clean and Tidy is also the name of an operation that the Israeli government carried out against migrant workers. And, you know, many people in the NGO world, I mean, just the name, right? Clean and Tidy, as though these people, these human beings are dirty and need to be, you know, cleaned out and tidied up. So, yeah. According to both the media and the Israeli government, there have been two major crackdowns on undocumented workers. The first began in 2002 with the formation of the Immigration Administration and was conducted in full force from 2003 to 2005. The second began in July of 2009 when the OZ unit hit the streets. That these two campaigns were separated by 4 years might give the impression that there was a period of quiet for migrant workers, a time they felt safe. Rather, many migrant workers told me that the crackdowns were spikes in pressure that never let up. Even between the campaigns, the immigration police were on South Tel Aviv streets, checking papers, pounding on doors, turning apartments upside down in the middle of the night. That's why Tita's husband slept in the car still when I volunteered in her black market kindergarten in 2007 and 2008. Christine Garli Talana saw her husband deported in 2003 when she was 8 months pregnant. He was caught in front of me, she recalled. 7 years later, immigration police showed up at the office where she managed and edited Focal, a magazine for the local Filipino community. Israel wasn't deporting women with children at that time, and Talana explained to authorities that she had a son. But she didn't have his paperwork on hand, and she couldn't take them to the black market kindergarten he attended because the babysitter didn't have a visa. So they detained her, putting her in a van. Then they made rounds, picking up other migrant workers. The immigration police did this sometimes. They drove mothers around in vans to intimidate them, to pressure them into leaving on their own, to take their children with them. Sometimes they would ask the women to sign papers in Hebrew, papers that the women couldn't understand. But this time they took Talana and the others to a facility in Holon that for many is the first stop on their way to expulsion. There, authorities continued to insist that Talana didn't have a child. I had to have my son brought to Holon so they would let me out, she said, adding, children suffer when things like this happen. On another occasion, Talana and her son were terrorized by a 4 a.m. raid. Immigration officers told me, this isn't your home, this isn't your country, you don't belong here. They searched the house without a warrant, claiming they were looking for drugs. They treated her, Talana recalled, like a criminal. We spoke in 2008 between crackdowns. While arrests had subsided somewhat, Talana said, many of her acquaintances remained more scared of immigration officers than they are suicide bombers. If you send a worker home, you kill the rest of the family members because he is the breadwinner. For discussion's sake, I pointed out that the economy in the Philippines was growing. It was one of the strongest in Southeast Asia. So why did Filipinos keep telling me they can't find work there? Talana shrugged. The government is corrupt, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Education doesn't matter, it's all about who you know. I'm a Filipina, she continued. I'm proud to be one, but I've found my life here. She added that despite the ongoing harassment from Israeli authorities, the community was very free here in comparison to the Arab countries where many Filipinos were deployed. Others who'd worked in Saudi Arabia told me how their bags had been searched at the airport. their crucifixes and Christian Bibles confiscated. In Lebanon, migrant workers were committing suicide. Some died as they attempted to escape their employers. In Israel, we are free to practice our religion and culture and tradition, she continued, adding, this is the Holy Land. This alone attracts Filipinos. We're at home here. I interviewed Talana in her small, nondescript office in the Tachana Merkezi, or central bus station. Focal had folded. Her Israeli business partner had stolen it from her, she claimed. Talana had recently started a new English language publication. Like Focal, it was made with Israel's large Filipino community in mind, but this one had a subversive name, Zarim. That's what most Israelis called them, Ovdim Zarim, foreign workers. Zarim translates literally to both foreigners and strangers. To a Hebrew speaker, one concept doesn't come without the other. Skits on the popular Israeli satire show, Eretz Nehderet, A Wonderful Country, captured this connection. The sketches depicted comedian Yair Netzani explaining curious aspects of Jewish or Israeli life to a panel of migrant workers. At the beginning of each segment, Netzani welcomed them in heavily accented English. Hello and good evening to all the strange workers. The studio audience laughed. It sounded like a mistake, a comical mistranslation, but it's not. Rather, with that single word, Netzani revealed the Israeli relationship to these non-Jews. They are odd. They are different than us. They are weird. They are others. Menachem Friedman, a former Israeli soldier who has taken up the cause of refugee rights, explains the deeper cultural connotation that comes along with the word in a country where every school kid, secular or religious, studies Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. In a language fraught with biblical background, Ovdim Zarim also carries connotations of Avodah Zarah, literally strange worship, the biblical term for idolatry. In the Bible, idolatry is the cardinal symbol of the corrupting influence of foreign cultures on the Jewish polity. The Israelites are constantly reminded not to mingle with the nations surrounding them, lest they be tempted to worship idols, an act which would lead to their destruction as a people. In the beginning, even advocates called them Ovdim Zarim. What today is the hotline for refugees and migrants was originally the hotline for foreign workers. But at some point, they started using the term Megrei Avodah, migrant workers. Not only was the phrase more politically correct, it also carried its own biblical weight. At the root of Megrei is Ger, a word that refers to a different kind of foreigner or stranger, a non-Jew who lives among the Jews and must be protected. Just as the commandment to care for the strangers among us appears more times in the Bible than any other, so I heard innumerable Israeli activists and advocates cite this commandment as an argument for migrants and asylum seekers' rights. For the people of the book in which God created the universe with a word, language was a battleground. And Talana, a Filipina who spoke fluent Hebrew, waged a quiet war from her little office in South Tel Aviv. Publishing her magazine, the title an attempt to claim the word as the community's own. Within the calendar year, Zarim would fold. Eventually, Talana and her son left for the Philippines. In the period between the crackdowns, the immigration police started showing up at Pastora's Black Market Kindergarten. Neither her church, actually let me pause and give a little bit of background. So we follow a character throughout the book who I've called the Pastora. She's a Filipino woman pastor. And you have these churches in South Tel Aviv in particular, these kind of unmarked, kind of underground Christian churches. Now, Israel in the early 2000s focused on deporting men in an attempt to break up migrant worker families. So they would deport husbands. So that's why Talana, you know, they picked her husband up off the street because they're walking together. Clearly they're in a relationship. She's pregnant. They deported the men in hopes that the women would follow. So in this time, you actually saw a lot of the male pastors deported from Israel. And so the female, the Filipino women kind of rose in their place. And you have a number of women pastors in Israel. And, you know, they say that the phenomenon came about because the men were deported. So Pastora is one of these, you know, woman pastors that is running a church in South Tel Aviv. It's on Neve Sha'anan Street, across from the central bus station, and it's not marked. There's no, of course, the police know where it is, you know, but it's not marked. And her church is probably about this big, about the size of this room. And she, during the day, puts the chairs aside and runs a black market kindergarten there. Now, hers is one of the better black market kindergartens. She has volunteers who come. It's much more professional. It's not one of these, you know, horrible places. I just want to make that clear in Pastora's defense, you know. In the period between the crackdowns, the immigration police started showing up at Pastora's black market kindergarten. Neither her church nor her kindergarten had a sign, but Israeli authorities didn't need one. They followed Filipino women with strollers to find the babysitters. They came up the stairs behind the mothers, ending up at Pastora's door. By early 2009, she started keeping the gate at the bottom of the stairwell locked. She knew she couldn't stop the police from coming, but it brought her some time when they showed up. She had a worker without a visa, a woman who had lost legal status because she'd had a baby. Pastora's husband had left his job, and because of the binding arrangement, he'd lost his visa. He was also helping out in the gun in the black market kindergarten. So when the police showed up downstairs and began banging on the gate, Pastora hid Ernell, her husband, and the woman behind the heavy, floor-length, burgundy velour curtains. Then she rushed to let the police in. There were five or six of them, she recalls. "Why did it take you so long?" they asked. "You were hiding something." As the children looked on, the uniformed men ruin everything and they open everything, she says, dumping toys on the floor. Frightened, some of the little ones burst into tears. The police went to the rooftop and returned to take one last look in the gun, heading for the curtains. Pastora began to pray. They opened one set of drapes and found nothing. A little girl sat wailing before the other set of curtains, the ones that hid Pastora's employee and her husband, Ernell. "I went there to the child to take her," Pastora recalls. She picked the girl up and, pointing a finger in her face, an immigration officer told Pastora, "I'm going to close this gun if we find someone here without a visa." It was very intimidating. I wanted to collapse. The police took Pastora's full name and her passport number. They left, but then came summer of 2009, and along with it, the announcement that migrant families would be expelled. Most of these families were Filipino. The announcement came just days after a monument had been erected in the Israeli city of Rishon LeZion in commemoration of the fact that the Philippines had opened its doors to the Jews during the Holocaust. In 1939, the then president, Manuel Quezon, someone help me, had set aside land on the island of Mindanao, hoping to help 10,000 Jews settle there. But World War II reached Filipino shores, putting an end to these plans. Only 1,200 Jews made it to the country, the same number of children that Israel now planned to expel. Mm-hmm. Do we have time for a little bit more reading?
Sure.
Okay. In autumn of 2009, I received a phone call from an acquaintance, Hermie Ocampo, a prominent member of the highly organized and media-savvy Filipino community. I'd met Ocampo earlier in the year when I interviewed her brother-in-law, Jesse, for a story about a shyster who'd made hundreds of thousands of shekels by promising scores of undocumented workers something called a protection visa in exchange for cash. Needless to say, no such visa category existed. Jesse, a caregiver who lost his work permit after his elderly employer died, found himself stripped of both his legal status and his savings. The immigration police had investigated the lawyer, a Palestinian citizen of the state, and passed their findings in a recommendation that the attorney be prosecuted for fraud along to the Justice Ministry. The Justice Ministry did nothing. Now Hermie called. Hermie's son, Ilan, had received status after the state opened the first one-time window for migrant workers' children. His permanent residency carried her and her husband. So the family was safe from deportation. But a number of her friends and their children, who ranged in age from 8 to 24, were facing expulsion. Would I come to Ramat Gan to meet them? I took the bus east from Tel Aviv. The two cities blended together. The shift from Tel Aviv's black on white street signs to Ramat Gan's white on green, the only reminder that I crossed the line between the two. I got down at the agreed upon stop and Hermie picked me up. Tiny, her highlighted hair freshly coiffed, her makeup precise, her clothes immaculate, a collection of bangles glimmering and jiggling on her wrist as she talked, drove, and slept, swept long bangs out of her eyes all at once. The beat-up, faded old car, no AC, windows down, didn't match Hermie's shine. and she seemed to hover in the driver's seat, pushing the thing along with the tap of her high heels and a flick of her wrist, floating past the drab Soviet-style apartment blocks. Hermy parked, and I followed her up a stairwell to the apartment of a Filipino family I'll call the Rosarios. We entered, and I found not one but three families waiting to speak with me, friends who also lived in Ramatgan and who were also facing deportation. They sat on dark blue couches among the trappings of what seemed to be less a migrant's apartment and more a well-appointed Israeli home. On a dining hutch stood two hanakiot, candelabras, I don't know how to say this word, like what the American Jews call a menorah. A tanakh and the kippot the Rosario father and son wore when they welcomed Shabbat on Friday nights and celebrated Jewish holidays. The Rosarios had been in Israel for two decades. Mr. Rosario had arrived in 1987. His wife and their then five-year-old son, C, joined him in 1990. A few years later, another baby came, this time a girl. The family was able to live and grow together legally because both Mr. and Mrs. Rosario were employed by foreign embassies. This meant they were on different visas than other migrant workers. But their permits, which afforded them a little more stability, were the only thing that set them apart from other Filipinos in Israel. Their jobs were blue collar. Their children weren't recognized by the state, but attended Israeli schools. They brought both Hebrew and Judaism home with them. The kids had passed the language and culture on to their parents, and it became an essential part of the family fabric, threads woven through their lives. But the children hadn't received status in 2005 and 2006, despite the fact that they met all of the government's criteria. Officials from the Ministry of Interior told them that their application had been rejected because they were already legal. The window had only been open, Israeli authorities argued, for illegal children. In a twist of irony, the same visa that had enabled the family to live together in Israel all those years was suddenly a liability. In order to remedy this curious problem, they quit their jobs and became illegal. They also got a lawyer. Their case had been stalled in the system ever since. And while being undocumented just a few years ago would have been rewarded with naturalization, now it meant that they were subject to deportation. The teenage daughter, Kay, emerged from her bedroom. She was headed to her dance class, and in fluent, unaccented Hebrew, she advised her parents of her other plans for the evening. She greeted me casually in Hebrew, without Filipino niceties, and got straight to the point. I'm Israeli. Hoping she would elaborate, I asked a few probing questions. Hearing my American accent, Kay switched to English, the language she spoke with her parents and other foreigners. I don't understand the Filipino language, she said. If I'm deported, it will be hard for me. I'll have to start my life all over again. Feeling no need to explain herself, her presence in the country, or why she should be able to stay, Kay dashed out the door. Her parents filled in some of the blanks for her. Like many Jewish Israeli teenagers, 16-year-old Kay had recently taken an army preparation course. After high school, most Israelis do mandatory military service. Not only is it a rite of passage, it's also an entry card into Israeli society. And Kay couldn't imagine herself not enlisting. But without status, she wouldn't be able to join. She also hoped to join her class on the trip they would make later in the school year to Poland, where they would visit Auschwitz and other Holocaust sites. Leaving Israel, however, meant that she might not be able to get back in. The Rosario's 24-year-old son had also faced a number of problems. C slouched out of his room to explain. He was studying biology at Tel Aviv University, but without status, he was unable to work legally. His job prospects would be bleak after graduation, despite the fact that he spoke Hebrew like it was his mother tongue. Despite his education, C would likely end up cleaning houses or washing dishes. When C was younger, he'd represented Israel in international math competitions, donning a kippah at those events, enhancing the country's image as a place of diversity. But now that same country didn't want the diversity to stay. The two other families I met that night at the Rosario's home were also embassy cases, so-called embassy cases. Eldi and Judith Trinanis had come to Israel in the early 1990s to work for an Italian diplomat. Before their employer left the country, and Eldi and Judith lost legal status, they had two children, Michelle, 14, and Michael, 8. Michelle, a pretty girl with a round face and large eyes rimmed with thick eyelashes, had been in the Sofim, the Scouts. While a majority of Jewish Israelis go to the military after high school, the enlistment rate for those who have been in the Sofim is even higher. Michael was on the other end of the living room, sitting on the floor, playing video games with the young son of the third family. Aldi and Judith were doing their best to shield Michael, a sweet, sensitive boy, from the fact that he might be forcibly returned to a country he never visited. So they called him over to one of the dark blue couches and asked him about school. His favorite class, he informed me, was sports. In Hebrew, he told me he loved kadorego, soccer. Judith smiled, stroked his hair, and asked about academic subjects, listing them in English. His favorite, he said excitedly in Hebrew, was anglit, English. And what about the holidays, I asked, not specifying whether I meant the Christian or Jewish holidays. Which do you like the most? Purim, he answered, sounding very much the little Israeli boy. For children, Purim is less about commemorating how Queen Esther saved ancient Persia's Jews from death and more about cookies, costumes, and noisemakers. Judith told Michael he could return to the video game, and he skipped away. She watched him waiting till he's busy playing to resume our conversation.
This week's version of One Land, Many Voices, featuring a talk and book reading by Maya Garnieri-Jaradot. That took place at Tabor Space in Portland on Tuesday, June 20th, 2017. And the book that she wrote, that Maya wrote, is The Unchosen, The Lives of Israel's New Others. And we'll listen to a little more music, and then we're going to get to the rest of the morning, which includes Air Cascadia at 10, at 10:15 Flashpoints, and then at 11 o'clock Pacific Underground will be with us. It's a show by Asians and Pacific Islanders taking the mic into their own hands right here at KBOO. It's 9:56, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Thank you.
KBOO members, thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here is an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There's a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 17th, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Black Women for Peace 2017 Peace Festival on Saturday, June 24th at 5 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory in Portland. The fourth annual Peace Festival